Accession number 10657, Reel 8.
Major Lewis, Reel 8. Where did you go to when you moved off from Maddalena?
Maddalena, we went back two positions outside Mersa Matruh. It had been decided to make a stand there, in fact.
How did you do the move to Matruh? Did you keep the same sort of formation?
Well, it was a mass move across the open desert again. So it would have been very similar, I think, to the formation that we'd had. I mean, when we moved as a battalion, we moved as a box, so we would have been moving as a battalion again, probably, I think. And we would have had probably light AK-AK on the flanks and anti-tank guns and that sort of thing. But I don't think we went back there sort of piecemeal or in a long convoy of trucks or anything like that. It's much more likely that we would have moved in desert formation.
What sort of distance did you cover then to get back to Matruh?
I don't know how far Matruh is from Maddalena, actually. I think it's got it in the book somewhere, but I honestly don't. If we can just stop that for a second.
When you were doing this move to Matruh, was that done in daylight?
Yes.
What happened in the hot part of the day when you were moving cross country?
Well, the hot part of the day was just absolutely sweltering hot. You know, you could lean out of the truck to try and get a bit of air, but the air was hot too. What happened was, when you stopped for a break, the lucky ones got underneath the truck fast, where they did get a bit of shade. But if you weren't lucky enough to get under there, then it was absolute purgatory, really, because it really was absolutely blazing hot.
How often would you stop on such a...
Every 2 hours, something like that. Stop for a few minutes, just to have a break, you know. But it was... There was no shade anywhere, only the shadow underneath the truck, and the shadow that it threw. Wherever it threw it, you could sit in that, propped up against the wheel or something. But we didn't have any... I can't remember anybody going mad with sunstroke or anything like that. But it was very, very unpleasant. Very unpleasant.
I was wondering about driving through the heat because of the haze effect, didn't that?
Not so much in the mornings. It's the afternoons when you get that. And it could well be... you could drive in the haze, but you can't carry out any sort of operation in it, you know. But maybe we would probably have done most of our driving during the early part of the day, and we may even had a fairly lengthy break at midday, something like that.
When you were doing this, did you have any idea at all about what was going on at a higher level, about the progress the enemy were making towards?
No, we knew that at that particular time, we knew that Tobruk hadn't fallen. We also knew that we'd managed to successfully break out of the Ghazala box and that we were going back to take up positions a bit further back. But I don't think it was until we got to El Alamein that everybody realised that really this had got to be the last place before a complete breakthrough to Europe, to Egypt, and beyond that to the oil fields. I don't think it worried us all that much. We got very worried after Tobruk fell, but that hadn't happened at this particular time.
Do you remember how long it took you to get to Matruh?
Must have been a day, I would think a day.
What sort of positions did you go into when you got there?
They were open desert positions. I think that we were on some sort of escarpment. something like that, you know. But it is a very complicated one. The truth is, it's all in there, and I just can't, not even if I read it through again, I can't remember it all. But they were open desert positions where we had to take up defensive positions expecting an attack to be made. So we had to set ourselves out and be prepared to meet an attack, which we eventually did get.
When you got there, were their positions already dug, or did you have to make them?
No, we had to make them. No, that we did have to do.
Roughly how long did it take you to get dug in?
Depends on the terrain, very largely. I mean, if it's very, very rocky, it can be a devil of a job. And if it's softish sand, it's fairly quick. But, I mean, being Durham miners, they were pretty good at making a fairly considerable hole fairly quickly. But you could say that it could take the whole of the morning, or the whole day even, before you were really successfully dug in, particularly if there was any rocky ground.
Was it rocky at Matru?
I can't remember. I think it probably was, more so than at Ghazala, because we were near this escarpment. Well, there were several escarpments round there. We were more up towards the coast now, where you do get more of that sort of rock formation.
How were you laid out in the company? Was it similar to the Ghazala position?
Well, we'd have had two platoons up and one back. You know, the classic defence situation with Vickers supporting us and the 3-inch mortars and all that sort of thing. It would have been an ordinary, straightforward defensive position, I would say. In fact, I'm sure it was.
And were you on the high ground of the escarpment or below it?
Well, I think we were. All the vehicles were sort of lagered up below the escarpment. And I think that the various infantry companies would have been more out in the open anyway than the vehicles were. They wouldn't have been under any sort of cover. But I really can't remember. The escarpment comes into it later on, very considerable, because that's where we were more or less ambushed, going over the top of the thing. But if I remember rightly, we were out in the... I mean, B Company was out in the open on a fairly level stretch of desert. We weren't on top of the escarpment or anything like that.
How long was it between the time you arrived then and started to prepare and the enemy attack?
I think an attack came in. Can't get this one. I think the first one came in the late afternoon, actually, of the first day that we were there, if I remember rightly. And I think they were using American Honey tanks, which they'd captured. And our anti-tank guns knocked them all out, which was pretty good. But we got the new six-pounders by then. I think the six-pounders had arrived, more or less. We were able to pick them up when we got to Matru.
As you were withdrawing back?
Yes, I think that they had come up. By that time, I think the Shermans had begun to arrive in fairly large numbers, as opposed to the Grant, which had that awful turret that wouldn't traverse, and the six-pounders as well. But Cyril Catford, who was in charge of the anti-tank guns, did a very good job and picked off most of these honey tanks. And that was that. So that particular attack was beaten off.
Was that actually on your company front?
Yes, they were. Yes, they were. So they would be coming in. They would have been coming towards us, in fact. But he was over on a flank from us.
So to your front, you had these tanks appearing and just motoring forward.
Yes.
How many of them were there, do you remember?
About 6 or 8, I think. But we thought they were our own. You know, the Hunnids were Americans, and we thought they, in fact, were ours. But what happened was that, if I remember rightly, they opened fire on somebody, which made it quite obvious that they were enemy and not ours. And it was at that point that... Ian Pitt reported the fact that they were there, And Catford was told to open up with his anti-tank guns, which he did.
What sort of formation were they in for this attack on you?
I think they were just in a line.
So a line abreast?
A line abreast, yes, coming forward like that.
Did they have any infantry with them?
No. No, not that we could see. No.
Was there any artillery bombardment of your position before?
No. So it was very much a probing thing, I think. Very much.
Is it possible they didn't know you were there and they just blundered into you?
Might have been. Or it might have been the fact that they thought that they had got superior firepower to us and wonder where are the fact that we got 6-pounders. Because up to that time we'd only had 2-pounders. And the 6-pounders made a tremendous difference, actually, to the anti-tank operations.
How close did they get before they were knocked out?
I suppose about... I should think about 600 yards, something like that.
How many shots do you think the anti-tank guns had to fire to hit them all?
15 or 20, I suppose. Something like that.
Have you any idea what sort of range they were shooting at?
I would think it would have been about 1,000 yards, something like that. When they first spotted them, anyway. But it was certainly the anti-tank guns that did it. I don't think the 25-pounders came in. They didn't have to.
Were the Hunnies firing at you as they advanced?
No, we weren't aware of being fired at anyway. They weren't physically firing at our positions. I mean, we were out of their view, probably, where we were, dug in.
When they were knocked out, did they just stop or did they also brew up?
Well, all I can recollect is that they stopped and that was that, and there was no further movement from them. I mean, maybe some of the crews had been killed, but I can't remember if any brewed up. Some must have done, I'm sure. I mean, it may well say so in there, but I'm sure some must have done. But we didn't see people jumping out of them left, right and centre and running back or anything like that. Had we done so, we might have opened up on them, I don't know.
At this stage, did you have a minefield in front of you?
No, there wasn't time to... It was supposed to have a minefield, I think, but the mines didn't arrive, so it couldn't be laid. So there was no minefield in front.
No wire or anything like that?
No, no.
So it was just your firing
just
pits?
Just a bit of open desert with the section pits, that's right.
So that was the first attack. What happened then? Presumably you had a break before the next push came in.
Yes. I do remember one rather humorous thing. I had a I had a marked map on a piece of telt board, and Ian Pitt, who was a company commander, told me to take it over to battalion headquarters because he'd marked up on it where he thought there was a German gunner OP or something, or might have been where the tanks had come from. Anyway, being a streaming hot day, I rushed across a bit of open ground, which was exposed to enemy fire, although there wasn't much going on, ran across to where the CO was and flung myself down next to him where he was lying, looking through a pair of binoculars, and said... B Company commander wants me to show you this smart map. Whipped it out from under my arm, and of course the perspiration and everything had worn the talc away. And Jake being Jake said something like, "You bloody fool, you." He says, "No, get back and get the damn thing marked up again," he said, "and come back with it." So again I had to run the gauntlet, as it were, across the open ground back to B Company, where I got another berating from my company commander, who also called me a bloody fool. Marked it up again, and again I went back, showed it to Jake. This time it was all right, and then yet again I made the little trip back to B Company headquarters.
How far was it between the two HQs?
About 300 yards, something like that. It was quite a long run, actually. If anybody had chosen to start plopping anything around then, it wouldn't have been so funny. But they're the sort of things you remember very vividly, much more so than others, really.
What did Company HQ consist of when you were in action?
Just the company commander. The second in command would be at rear company headquarters. The sergeant major would probably be with the second in command at rear company headquarters. And company headquarters, you'd have, I would have my signaller with an 18 set and a runner, because the platoons had their own runners, you know. And maybe the sergeant major between the two, between company headquarters and rear company headquarters.
What about battalion headquarters?
Battalion headquarters, that would be the CO, the RSM, the adjutant, of course, the signals officer would probably be there, in fact he would be, the IO would be there as well. Battalion headquarters would be a much bigger operation than company headquarters, in fact.
When you were actually in action, did you rely primarily on verbal orders, or did you go through the formal procedure of issuing written orders?
Oh no. You do know, I cannot remember. I don't think I can remember an occasion when I wrote out a signal on a piece of paper. It was really verbal most of the time. I don't know what it was like, probably when we got bogged down a bit in Sicily, then you'd have possibly had written orders, and I think written orders came down to brigade, came down to battalion from brigade, but I don't think there was a lot of that between the companies and battalion headquarters, because you'd got your company 18 set, which worked back to battalion headquarters.
So from battalion downwards, it would be pretty well all verbal, would it?
I think so, yes. Well, certainly it was that way in the desert anyway.
When you gave these verbal orders, were they given in standard form, or did you have a sort of verbal shorthand to convey your requirements?
No, I mean, you'd got your... What was it called? You'd got information about your own troops, information about the enemy, objective, method, and administration. I think that's what it was. I forget the exact wording. But that followed the same style every time when you were giving out orders. And you used that whether you were going to attack or whether you were going to be attacked. So the basic orders were always based on those same six items, I think they were. Certainly I can remember the first two. Information own troops, information enemy. Method was another thing. Objective, and there was one or two more, I think.
So it was a format that you
followed. Yes, it was a format that you followed when you gave orders to your platoon commanders. And it was exactly the same format that was followed by the battalion commander when he gave orders about his... when he gave orders to his company commanders. So I don't worry. It was a set thing, and it was really very good. It gave you all the information you wanted, and it also drew questions out of people, the way in which it was done. But it had to be done in a certain order. Otherwise, you didn't bring out the questions from people.
What happened next then at Matru? You'd had your tank
attack.
Well,
we'd had the tank attack. Then, because of the success of breaking out from Gazala, the brigadier decided that if we could do it once, we could do it again. And that what we would do, we'd be to break out of Mirza Matru in similar fashion to the Gazala breakout, shoot up the German lines of communication as we had at Gazala, but having done that, come back in again.
So you're going to do a massive raid?
Yes, a massive raid, rather like, I mean, almost as big as the Gazala breakout, but obviously not including the water carriers and all that sort of thing, the ambulances. But it was another massive raid on wheels through the German LFC, do as much damage as we possibly could. When we got to a certain distance, turn round and come back again. And we did exactly that, which is precisely the same operation as Gazala. But we did have more casualties this time than we had at Gazala, I think I'm right in saying. But we did very well. We got right the way through and shot out their LFC. I mean, on this particular occasion, the sort of thing that was happening there, they were so taken by surprise, the Germans, that I remember we had with us a Vickers machine gun mounted in the back of a 1,500 weight truck, who was actually with me. And we went into a German lager, or through a German lager, and we saw a little group of trucks, and we backed the Vickers up onto one of these that had got a tarpaulin on, and we literally backed the Vickers up onto this thing and absolutely riddled the tarpaulin with bullets from about 10 yards range. And it was full of a whole lot of unfortunate Germans inside having a sing-song or something. But they had no idea that we were anywhere near. When we came back, they were ready for us, so we got knocked about a bit on the way back.
Did you take the same route coming back then?
More or less, yes.
How far did you go when you drove out?
Oh, several miles. You know, right the way through the German forward positions, which was the other side of where the Honey tanks had been, and then beyond that, through their LFC, and then back again. I don't know whether it gives the mileage in there, but it would have been, oh, could have been a penetration of 7 or 8 miles, and then back in again.
And this was in battalion.
That was in,
was it?
I think it was in columns. I think it was in column strength again. I don't think it would have been, can't remember. It might have been the whole battalion together as one big wedge going through, rather than the separate columns that we'd used at Gazala. But we'd have to check that bit up. But I, you know, you, that can be an eerie business, because when you're, I remember coming back, on the way back, I got in behind a gunner's truck in the sort of convoy, and following very closely behind this gunner's truck, and there was a tarpaulin over the back, and there was a hand hanging out the back, and all it did was wave about. There was a dead man, obviously, but all I could see, and almost as near as you are from where I was sitting next to my driver, was this hand. And I couldn't help thinking, I wonder who it is. Who's on the other end of the hand? You know, is it somebody that I know? Because it was 74th Field Regiment, and they were our gunners. And it wasn't until we finally got back and we stopped and we went and had a look, and it was the gunner's signals truck, actually, and it wasn't anybody we knew. But it was this uncanny feeling of knowing that you're following behind somebody who's been killed and not knowing whether you know them. That's another thing that's always been in my mind. All the years.
Was this also a night operation?
Yes,
as well?
Night again. And that was only the second one, because we did it a third time when we actually broke out finally from Merzimatru. So in fact we did that type of operation three times within 7 or 8 days, I suppose, something like that.
And you were in a soft skin vehicle?
Yeah.
What was it, a lorry or a pickup?
1500 weight. I think I had a 1500 weight. It could have been a 3-ton lorry. It could have been a 1,500 weight. Probably more likely to have been a 3-ton lorry, I think, because there would have been some troops in the back of it.
And what were they supposed to do? Just fire over the sides as you went past?
That was the idea. To create as much confusion as we possibly could in the German rear areas. I can't recollect anybody else ever doing it. Not in the British Army. The Russians might have done it. But I don't recollect having read any stories of battalions carrying out that sort of operation. It was quite unique. Quite unique.
How did the men respond to this sort of thing?
They thought it was great, I think. They thought it was a little bit different, you know. It had a little bit of adventure, spicy sort of thing. They didn't... I think they moaned a bit when they knew we'd got to come back again. And they knew very well that we'd got to get out of there again, but they were getting used to it by now. After all, it's the third time we'd done it, you see.
On that second run through the German lines and back, you said that they were waiting for you when you came back.
They were waiting for us when we came back much more than they... Yes, that's right. I mean, going out from Gazala wasn't too bad. Going out from Merzimatru wasn't too bad, but coming back into Merzimatru was worse than going out.
Why? What sort of thing happened to you? What did you?
Well, I mean, we didn't come under fire once we were clear of the Gazala business, but as soon as we came back, They obviously were aware of what had happened at Gazala, so I suppose they said to themselves, well, there's a 50-50 chance they're coming back this time and not going straight on. So we did come under heavier fire coming back than we had on the outward journey. And that really was very much a question of putting your foot down whenever you could and just driving flat out.
Did you suffer any losses in your
platoon?
Yes, we
did. Yes, the exact number is there, I don't know, but we did suffer a certain number of losses on that one. But the heaviest ones, of course, were on the next part, on the actual
final breakout
from Merzabetru, when we had a very bad time there because we got caught in a wadi, and the troop carriers down in the bottom of the wadi, and they had to go up these steep sides, almost like a cliff face. And of course, as they breasted the top, right on the skyline, and what they didn't knock out in the wadi, the Germans, they got going over the top. We had a lot of casualties there, actually, much more than on any of the others. I mean, they really were ready for that one.
When you had casualties in that operation, what effect did that have on the rest of the platoon?
Well, they didn't know about it until the following morning. And by the time the following morning comes, you're always able to say to yourself, well, old Jack will turn up, or old Jonesy will be back, don't worry about him. You don't necessarily really, when you're split up like we were like that, you're not aware of people dropping around you all the time. It doesn't happen like that, you know. You don't really know until you get back.
They were missing.
Missing, that's right. Well, where's Bill? You know, a section will say, where's old Charlie Sanso? Oh, last saw him trying to get on a three-tonner. Something like that, you know. They start to pull it all together then, and then they can get a bit depressed, because it can get very depressing. Because that's the stage where you know that a lot of people aren't any longer with you, but you don't know how many of them are going to come back eventually. And that is probably the most psychologically the worst stage of, I mean, Matru was nothing, but battles like Marath and Prima Soli were very, very bad indeed. And that is the stage, you know, when everybody's missing before you know when they're going to turn up again.
Is there anything you can do to ameliorate that?
Nothing really. You can only say to them that don't worry, they'll turn up. You know, they've probably joined a 6th battalion column, or they've probably gone through with another column. Don't worry, we'll see them in a couple of days' time. Because it's so very fluid and open, you know. It's not like being in a trench in World War One, where you know that 8 men were killed at 11 o'clock by a mortar bomb or something, and you know who they were. You don't know until everybody gets gathered together.
Do you think that the uncertainty was worse than the positive knowledge?
The uncertainty of
what had happened to them?
No, I don't think so, because while there's life, there's hope, and they didn't accept the fact that it's very difficult, you know, for one man might say, oh, Corporal so-and-so, he'll be all right, he's okay, nothing will happen to him, you know, that sort of thing.
Did you bring back anyone who was wounded?